The question is vexing. Are we alone? The very question itself is strange among the many questions we can ask as curious human beings. We're not asking what we could do or where we could go or anything like that. But instead we look into the vastness of space and say to ourselves, is there anyone else out there? Somewhere? It seems in some ways like there should be. After all, our star is just one of a few hundred billion in this galaxy alone, which itself is just one unremarkable galaxy among 2 trillion others in the observable universe. There are probably many more beyond that. The numbers actually at some point become preposterous. The Sun is just one of something on the order of 1 in 10 to the 24th stars in the observable universe. The vast majority, ostensibly, as far as we know, habitable. It seems as though we should not even remotely expect to be alone. But yet, as David Brin long ago termed it, all we see is the great silence. But the history of wondering about the question of are we alone in the universe is very deep and storied. It's something that I've never covered in a video. There are no new discoveries to report here. Just the stories of the people that led us to today and our technological search for alien life. The idea of alien life in some form, that is perhaps separate from religion, is perhaps prehistoric, but we first see it in a more modern context with the ancient Greeks, particularly Democritus, who proposed a plurality of worlds. Likewise in Christianity, early writers such as St. Augustine in City of God wrote about it, specifically on a much older idea from Epicurus of innumerable worlds interspersed through the immensity of space. One wonders how they knew that, but they did. Later in Renaissance Europe, William Vorlong suggested that Jesus of Nazareth might have visited other worlds to bring them redemption. And Nicholas of Cusa wrote in the 1440s that Earth was just one of many celestial objects, and that life could exist on any number of others. Often these ideas are credited to Giordano Bruno, but these kinds of ideas were more widespread in those days than is generally known. Bruno himself, however, suggested it rather strongly among many of his other ideas, which put him afoul of church authorities and he was burnt at the stake for it. But it was actually more complicated than merely his talking about alien life. There was much more to Giordano Bruno than that, and many reasons why he ran into trouble. Later, no less than Descartes advanced an idea that's every bit as relevant today, very much so, as it was centuries ago when he proposed it. That there actually is no way to prove that the stars are not inhabited by intelligent life. You could only prove it if you found it. You can't disprove it because absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. But he also pointed out that the existence of such things is speculation, until you find it. And that brings us to the modern age of SETI. Often it's said that the age of SETI began with Giuseppe Cocconi and Philip Morrison's seminal 1959 paper suggesting searching for radio beacons. But again, the story actually didn't start there. Indeed, Johannes Kepler in the early 17th century trained his telescope on the moon and saw what he thought were cities and structures, which were just the craters. And later ideas in that century included building a dedicated telescope to look for animals walking around on the moon that never came to fruition. Mistaken identities with things initially suspected of being alien that turned out not to be would go on to play a great role in just how SETI is done today, and how careful the scientists involved are in regards to ambiguous detections, such as the famous WOW signal of 1977. We still don't know what that was, but since it hasn't ever repeated, and remains a mystery, but is most certainly not proof of anything, just a spurious, intriguing signal. Before that, however, there were other detections. The most famous of these was by none other than Nikola Tesla in 1899. Tesla was experimenting with radio heavily in the 1890s and detected some kind of signal that he concluded was coming from Mars, because the odd repeating signal always stopped when Mars set in the sky. We still don't know exactly what Tesla heard, but it was the very earliest days of radio, and he may have misinterpreted a great many things, including the possibility that he was actually picking up Marconi's experiments with radio transmissions in Europe. And there is a kind of elephant in the room, in that Jupiter often belts out natural radio signals very prominently, And it may well actually have been that, since it actually does sound similar to what Tesla described, repeating waves of static. Marconi also reported this in 1921, however, or something like it, which also remains unexplained. Tesla is also noteworthy in that he also suggested using his radio transmitter technology on a larger scale to try to communicate and message anyone that might be on Mars. This was never done, but it wasn't the first time that that had been suggested. Actually, quite a few of Tesla's contemporaries also suggested as much, including Marconi, David Todd, and Lord Kelvin. But long before then, in the early 19th century, there had been ideas to set huge bonfires or going out and drawing geometric shapes in the Sahara that the Martians might see. In 1924, however, just such an experiment was done when Mars passed closer than it had in the previous 80 years to Earth. There was actually a coordinated effort by astronomer David Todd in the US for periods of radio silence during this close pass so that astronomers using a primitive radio telescope, but also broadcasters, and a concerted effort from many sources, including the US military, which was asked to listen, the first time as far as I know any government did anything with SETI, could all listen to see if there was anything coming from Mars. At the time, there were certainly skeptics and naysayers, and in this case, they were right. Nothing was found. At least, almost nothing. There actually was a detection of something during the 1924 experiment. A number of radio operators reported signals, but most noteworthy was the radio station WOR in Newark, New Jersey, reported some type of signal that persisted for about 2 hours, but they heard no coherence in it. That was never explained. But it has to be noted here that not all radio stations in the US complied with this, and very few, if any, worldwide. So ultimately, it's yet another oddity in radio to add to a growing list of weird signals that sometimes get picked up. What we do know now, though, is Mars is a dead world, with no radio transmissions coming from anyone there, just the radio murmurs of our active probes. In 1950 came the infamous lunch at Los Alamos where Enrico Fermi blurted out the question during a discussion of alien life, well, where are they? Thus, the Fermi paradox was born. Though in its original form, it was just a lunch conversation on Fermi's part. After all, if alien life is everywhere in the galaxy, then we probably should be seeing evidence of it. Interestingly, this also came at a time when the pop culture at large became interested in UFO sightings, naturally pressing the question of alien life, regardless of what was behind the sightings. A question that continues to this day. In 1959 came the Kokonian-Morrison paper that launched modern radio SETI, the first experiment in this new frame of thinking about SETI, that's still fundamentally how radio SETI is done today, was Frank Drake's Project OSMA. Beginning in April of 1960, Drake began using the radio telescope at Green Bank Observatory. He scanned two nearby stars, Epsilon Eridani and Tau Ceti. Incidentally, OSMA is what it sounds like. It was a reference to the Wizard of Oz, meaning a faraway place with strange beings, fitting for the aliens Drake was searching for. By the 1970s, there was one major radio SETI experiment up and running. It was the Big Ear Telescope at The Ohio State University. This telescope was originally designed to survey the hydrogen clouds of the Milky Way galaxy, which emit radio at the 21-centimeter line. It did that, but ultimately the funding dried up as the project collected a large amount of data that's still in use today, and the researchers involved were left with an idle radio telescope. As a result, they fitted it with a different receiver to search around the hydrogen line for alien communications. Given the fact that every astronomer in the galaxy is going to know how hydrogen emits at those frequencies, giving a natural place to put a signal saying hello. In the over 25 years that telescope operated in that capacity, it only ever picked up two signals. The first was the infamous WOW signal, which remains a mystery to this day but hasn't repeated. The other were odd bumps in the night signals that also remain unexplained and are now somewhat obscure in the annals of SETI. Similar signals were actually picked up in the 90s by Harvard during one of their SETI surveys. The 1990s were a difficult time for NASA-funded SETI searches because all of them were effectively canceled, forcing SETI into the private arena where it has operated ever since. That's at least radio SETI. NASA has recently shown renewed interest not so much in radio technosignatures alone, but the entire corpus of things scientists have come up with to look for in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence at large, Dyson spheres, terraformed worlds, and so on. But we are also in the golden age of privately funded SETI, with a fully private radio telescope array, the Allen Telescope Array, dedicated largely to SETI, and of course the $100 million project Breakthrough Listen, which is active and funded by Yuri Milner. Breakthrough Listen is interesting because it is very comprehensive, seeking to scan 1 million stars in our area of the galaxy, but also the galactic center and even nearby galaxies. Advances in computer technology and AI have allowed for much more efficient searches, unheard of in the 1970s, often without the need for a human to even look at the data. Even more is being done with old datasets that were scanned by computers, but with new algorithms tuned to look for signals that might have been missed the first time. And those new algorithms have found no shortage of candidate signals, actually millions of them. The problem is, they never repeat. It's very easy to think of SETI as a long shot, and something that in decades of being done hasn't yielded anything definitive. But it pays to remember that until now, SETI was very limited and very difficult. Even during the days of SETI at home, where citizen scientists could donate their computer power to crunching data, today it's much, much more comprehensive because of the advances in computing power since the early 2000s. But in that sense, it pays to remember that we're just only now truly approaching a comprehensive ability to be up to the task of actually doing efficient, effective SETI searches, enough to where if this continues another 30 years with no luck, we may begin to ask the question of whether we may currently be alone in the Milky Way. That does not speak to the rest of the universe. We have very little way of studying it at those distances, other than the most nearby of galaxies. But if the Great Silence survives a few more decades, then we can start to ask that question, or alternatively, whether we even know how to spot aliens. But it may not make it that far, because all that's needed is one single verifiable detection, and it could come at any time. Thanks for listening. I'm futurist and science fiction author John Michael Godier, currently musing. You know, if you go on the shortwave bands these days, there really isn't much to listen to compared to what was available in the 1990s. Yet we're still fully capable of transmitting on shortwave. It's just fewer see value in doing so these days. We've went mostly quiet, even though we can do it simply because of circumstances. That's food for thought when thinking about radio SETI. Maybe transmissions are rare because they end up not being situationally all that useful. Anyway, be sure to check out my books at your favorite online book retailer and subscribe to my channels for regular in-depth explorations into the interesting, weird, and unknown aspects of this amazing universe in which we live.